People will talk. Welcome to the podcast. Very nice to have you here. And
Thank you.
I would just like to know, why did you first make the move from California?
Well, I kind of think of it as destiny in a way. After I graduated from university in 2000, my good friend Wendy and I decided to take a backpacking trip around Europe. We spent a month here. We traveled around to some wonderful, we went to different countries and cities, and all the places were really wonderful. But what happened was, when I was in Barcelona, which was the last stop, I sort of felt like the overwhelming need to live there. Like I felt like I had to move to Spain. I don't know why, but that's what happened. And in fact, that was our last stop, as I mentioned. So when we were about to take our flight back to the States, I was literally in tears. I was so upset because I didn't want to leave. So when I got back to the States, rather than applying for graduate school, which was what I was going to do, I was going to get my MFA in creative writing and a doctorate in literature and teach university and all that. Well, I looked for teaching certification courses in Barcelona, which I found. So the following year, in 2001, I moved to Barcelona. I had planned on teaching English abroad for 2 years before returning again to the States. And well, that was nearly 20 years ago. So that's how I ended up here.
So it's clear you absolutely adore Spain. What would be the kind of the most attractive thing about living here? What kind of draws you so closely to Spain?
Well, if you're asking me to compare Spain to the US, which I do a lot, there are two things that would top my list. Number one is our fabulous national health system. We don't have anything like this in the U.S. I feel very lucky to live in a country where, you know, health is considered a right as opposed to a privilege. And sad to say, but I also have to mention the fact that I live in a country with strict gun laws. Maybe I watch the news a bit too often, but here I don't have to feel scared of sending my children to school or going to a shopping mall, you know, that we're going to be involved in a mass shooting. Maybe that's a bit dramatic, but I think about it a lot. And well, if we're talking about Spain itself, I would say I like the slower pace of life, the delicious food, of course. I love the food here, as everybody does. The sort of outdoor lifestyle, you know, going to a sidewalk cafe to have tapas and a drink. And also the fact that here in Spain, you know, you can go to a restaurant, say, and you could linger for hours after you eat. You know, the servers don't chew you out of the restaurant because they want to get new customers in. So it's just sort of a more relaxed lifestyle in general. Of course, we have beautiful beaches and mountains. We have everything here. And last but not least, of course, the people I've met here, both Spanish and foreign. Everything, basically.
That's fantastic. Yeah, some wonderful reasons there for making a home in Spain. And one thing that really interests me about you is, of course, you're a writer, and we'll talk about your poetry book as well over the course of this interview. And congratulations as well, by the way, on your pending publication.
Thank you.
What interests me about you as well is that you've also managed to make a career outside of teaching. So you're a teacher, but also you've done things beyond that. And that always fascinates me when I'm talking to people who are foreigners living in this country. Was it difficult for you to achieve this?
You know, you mentioned the word career. I really don't know if I would consider poetry a career per se. It's obviously more than a hobby, but, you know, I consider teaching my career. But anyway, I've dreamed of publishing my poetry since I was literally 8 or 9 years old, which is when I started writing it, and of becoming a writer, which I suppose meant making a living as a writer, which is not what I do. It's hard to, almost impossible to make a living as a poet in terms of making enough money to survive. I kind of consider myself just a telephone English teacher who has returned to writing and started publishing a few years ago and who has her first collection out soon. Does that qualify as a career? I don't know. But as I mentioned, I can't think of it as a hobby either, because then I probably wouldn't be disciplined or motivated enough to sacrifice things such as sleep or entertainment to write. So I don't know. I teach and I write, and I don't really give it much of a label for the moment.
Okay, very interesting. And I always find as well that teaching can be a very flexible thing. It can be adapted to other parts of a person's life, for example. And as a writer myself, I find that teaching can be very complementary to writing. Have you found the same? Have you found that there can be an overlap between your teaching and your writing, that they can influence or feed each other?
Yes, definitely, definitely. I teach business English and everyday English, which means, as you know, that I work with language such as grammatical structures and vocabulary and those kind of things on a daily basis. And these are the same things I use to manipulate language and to play with language in order to write poems. So one of the things that happens sometimes when I'm teaching is when I'm correcting student work, I mark things on their paper, and sometimes they say, "Is this sentence wrong?" And I say, "Well, no, grammatically it's correct, but, well, it's more beautiful this way." So, that's a little bit of the influence from my poetry. And it also works, it works in reverse as well. My teaching also influences my poetry in that, you know, many poets these days and also in the past deviate from grammatical rules such as capitalization or punctuation. But I think because I'm an English teacher, I just can't bring myself to experiment, you know, with these types of things in my poetry because, well, I just happen to be a stickler for grammar. So I try to make my poems as grammatically correct as possible. And I don't know if I'll ever change in that aspect. And that definitely comes from my teaching.
You mentioned something about language as well, which kind of gives me a question as well, would be, coming from California, as you do, and there's a bit of a Spanish influence there. Did you come already armed with some Spanish, or did you learn it completely from scratch when you first came here?
Yeah, very little, very little. I took 2 years of high school Spanish, and I took 1 year at university. So I knew basic grammatical structure, sort of, kind of. And when I came here, I could have simple conversations or make requests in shops. But really, I learned the language by being immersed in the culture and by surrounding myself with non-English speaking people. And that's how I learned. You know, you put yourself in situations where you're forced to use the language. And it's almost like magic. You learn. It comes to you because you have to use it. And nowadays, I'm completely fluent.
That's fantastic. Some people come to Spain and never learn a word. So we kind of learned, you mentioned your kind of process of learning language, total immersion. And I wonder if we go back to your writing, if we can see a process here as well. More specifically, you know, how often do you write, and how would you categorize your creative process?
Okay. I don't write as often as I would like to. As we talked about before, I'm a teacher. I have my full-time teaching job. I also have two very young children, a three-year-old boy and a six-year-old girl. And my wife has quite a big, close-knit family whom we spend, you know, with whom we spend as much time as possible, and we have our friends. So that means afternoons are out, weekends are out. My wife wakes up at 5 o'clock every morning to go to work. And so many times I also wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning and I try to write from 5 to 7. And that works quite well most of the time because I'm a morning person. Other times I stay up late. When everybody goes to sleep, maybe I'll get some writing done from, say, 10 to midnight. And also, writing isn't always about just sitting down and looking at the computer screen. Sometimes if I'm in the middle of a poem, I'll come up with lines, say, I don't know, in the shower. I don't know why, but hot water really stimulates the your creative thought. I don't know why. Or when I'm in the car or taking a walk. And at those times, what I do is I just jot it down in my phone. I take a screenshot. And then when it's time to write, I have those lines with me. So basically here and there, you know, poems, my poems don't come out in all in one fell swoop, you know, they come together little by little. And in terms of my creative process, I can talk about the types of poems I write, or the way I write poems. Sure. And I do that in a few different ways. Most of the time what I do is I just come up with like images or series of images, and I just go from line to line. And many times I don't really know what the poem is about. And then finally, at some point, some truth and reveals itself to me, and then I make adjustments or I change things. Sometimes I start a poem one way with one subject and it becomes something completely different. And so I just go with what the poem wants to do, because poems have minds of their own. I never try to go back to the original idea in that case. And then the other way I write poems, which isn't as useful because it doesn't always work, is I think of something I really want to write about, and then I look for information and images and details to fit the subject. But that's the most difficult way of writing a poem for me. And sometimes they just sort of die in the middle in that, when I'm using that method. So the best way for me is to just, you know, to use images and words and details, and then to see what the poem wants to say. So that's my creative process.
Ah, sounds very exciting. And, you know, these efforts, they have coalesced into a book, which we'll speak about in a moment. But also before the book, you know, I think you've put your work forward in some competitions at least. And even with the book, you know, your poems are going on display. Is it nerve-wracking kind of bringing them out to the public once they're done? Do you enjoy that part of it?
None of this is nerve-wracking for me at all. For me, it's just fun. As you mentioned, I don't enter competitions or contests very often, mostly because of the high submission fees. It can get expensive. I've only entered a few. In terms of like getting through the submission process and preparing yourself for rejections, you have to have sort of really thick skin. And I also kind of use sort of a psychological trick, but it's not really a trick. I really don't normally expect acceptances. I usually expect rejection. So when you get an acceptance, it's kind of like a pleasant surprise. But, you know, 90% or more of what you're going to receive are rejections. In the last 3 years, I was a finalist in a couple of competitions. I was nominated once for Best of the Net, but I've really never won anything, except if you count some writing awards from my university years. But my thought is that, you know, it's fun. I like the idea that there are people and editors out there reading my work. And really, if you're always getting acceptances and winning awards and that kind of thing, you know, it probably wouldn't be as exciting as it is for me.
That's very interesting to hear as well. I think, yeah, rejection is definitely a part of the creative process, and learning how to handle it is a fundamental part of it as well. And you've already mentioned here in the interview as well that you, you know, you kind of were always interested in writing from a very young age. And then there's a period of your life when you didn't write. So what was the moments that kind of pushed you back into poetry?
I am absolutely delighted you asked me this question, because that means I get to talk about my good friend, Karen Poppy. She's also she's a brilliant poet and writer. And well, Karen and I grew up in Foster City, California. We were next door neighbors for most of our life before we both went off to university, which is when we lost touch more or less with each other. But our lives have run parallel in many different ways, although we had no idea until decades later. So what happened was, in 2018, which was 17 years after I moved to Spain and stopped writing completely, I saw Karen, Karen posted a Facebook announcement. She said that she had just had a poem accepted for publication in a journal. So I had absolutely no writer. My friend and ex next door neighbor was a writer. So literally at that moment, I thought to myself, if she can do it, so can I. That was the thought I had. And that very same night, I sat down at my computer and I started writing a poems again. And I haven't stopped since. And, you know, she was very helpful the first year when I was submitting and I had lots of questions. I had no idea what I was doing. And we still keep in touch. We're very good friends. We actually just did a reading together, more or less, Sunday night. But really, really, if it hadn't been for her, I surely wouldn't be sitting here talking to you about my book and my writing life. So I'm very grateful to her. So hello, Karen.
That's so nice that there's that personal connection as well for kind of stepping back into poetry. And we've kind of touched on as well, navigating, submitting to competitions. And you've mentioned your book, which is amazing achievement. Is the publishing process difficult to navigate compared to, is it different from entering competitions? Are there different challenges, different dynamics? Or, because you already said you enjoyed submitting to competitions, is it also an enjoyable experience for you navigating that publication process? And also, because I'm sure we have some budding writers in the audience, is there any tips you could give anybody who might be embarking on their first book or have plans to publish a book someday?
Yes, I can only talk about poetry since it's the genre I write in. But yeah, publishing, as you said, is difficult, but it's not impossible. When I first started this, I thought it was going to be impossible to publish even one poem. I was completely wrong. So I do have lots of tips. First of all, there are literally thousands and thousands of literary magazines, journals in the US alone, and there are likely thousands more abroad. So there are so many places and so many chances to get your poetry or your writing stories or whatever published. If your poems are ready, I'll talk about poetry. If your poems are ready for submission, what I would say first and foremost is to submit wisely and often. Wisely meaning that read the journals you're going to submit to. There are so many journals, free online journals, and there are print journals as well. There are so many journals online, But if you don't read them first, you could, for example, end up, I don't know, sending a packet of 5 free verse poems to a magazine that only publishes poetry in traditional form, for example. You have to make sure that your poetry fits with the journal you're trying to publish it in. And by often, I mean submit to more places at once. Normally, I have about 20 or 25 simultaneous submissions out at one time. What that means is that simultaneous submission, what that means is that, for example, you could send the same 5 poems to 20 different places. Most of these journals allow simultaneous submissions. There are a few that don't allow this. And then in that case, you just have to wait for a response before you send them to a different place. Okay. What else? Read and follow the guidelines to the letter. Every magazine has its guidelines, but we're human, we make mistakes. I've made submission mistakes before, but if it's blatantly obvious that you haven't followed the guidelines, the editors will just delete your submission and they won't even read your poems. Always follow the guidelines. It's one of the most important things. When I first started, I would submit to magazines with very, very high acceptance rates. I did that to get some publications under my belt and to boost my confidence. And once I started getting a lot of publications, well, then I started trying for more challenging markets. But I think it's a good method, because if you're first starting out and you get like hundreds and hundreds of rejections because you're trying for the most difficult magazines, you might get discouraged. So that was a good method for me in the beginning. And speaking of rejections, never, never take them personally. Most of the time, it's not about your work. Maybe your poems didn't fit the vision that the editors had for the next edition, for the next issue. Or maybe, I don't know, you wrote 5 poems about outer space and they already accepted some poems about outer space they didn't want anymore. Or maybe your work is gorgeous and accomplished, but they just had limited selections and yours just didn't make the cut. And a lot of magazines curate their issues around themes, and maybe your poems didn't fit their theme, whatever. There are so many reasons, and normally it's not about your work. So try not to get discouraged. And in terms of rejection letters, there are 2 types. There are form letters, form rejections, and tiered, which means personal rejections. If an editor takes the time to write a personal note saying that they love your work and they encourage you to send again in the future, send again, because most of what you'll get is form. But if they take the time to do that, it's because they really, really want to see your work. And I've never worked as an editor, but this is what editors tell me, so I know it's true. And I think the most important thing to remember is never, never respond to a rejection in anger or insult editors. There are actually people who do this. I'm on the Twitter writing community, so I see a lot. And there are people who do this, and they write really nasty, responses to rejections. And editors will remember you, and they'll talk about you. And it's just unprofessional and bad taste. So I would recommend that if you're upset about a rejection, just send your work somewhere else. Don't say anything to the editors. And I think that's about it.
That's very informative. Thank you so much for bringing us through the different aspects of the publication process. I love because the rejection letter is also something so it looms large. Charles Bukowski has written a few poems about receiving them and how sometimes they can be also a sign of your progress as a writer. I also loved your part about reading the instructions carefully, because I think that's our teacher profile comes in there as well. Because one of the most common mistakes in exams would be students not reading the instructions properly, like the basic thing you can do. And you also mentioned earlier that you've written different styles of poems, and I guess the question would be now: do you have a preference for first person, third person, or maybe confessional pieces. I don't know. Is there one that kind of speaks to you more, or do you like wearing different hats, as it were?
Well, you know, lately I've been writing a lot of first-person confessional poems, but really it's what the poem calls for. Some poems want to be in first person, some want to be in third person. I just listen to the poem itself.
Okay.
In terms of my book, it's divided into three sections. The first section is third person observation poems. The second is persona poems. And what that means is that the I speaker of the poem is not me, the author. It's a persona I have created and whose voice I speak through. And then the last section is confessional poems. However, these distinctions can really get quite blurry because, for example, my confessional poems are not autobiography. There's lots of fiction involved. There are things that didn't really happen, or I embellished details, or I invented things, you know. And in maybe I'm confessing in some poems, I'm confessing a feeling, only a feeling, and I sort of wrapped up that feeling in a story that I made up, for example. Mm-hmm. Likewise, my persona poems, as I mentioned, it's a voice I'm speaking through, but maybe I, the author, have shared an experience with that persona, or I have the same sort of feelings, for example. And then in terms of third person, I would like to talk about a poem that I think you read, What She Remembers.
Yes.
It's a date rape poem. And it's written in third person. And it's the first poem I've ever had published. And when I first posted it on Facebook, one of my really good friends read it. And one of the things she said to me was, "You're so brave." And of course, I had to make it clear that it wasn't about me at all. It was something that I invented. It was an experience that maybe other people have had, but not me. But I could understand why she said that, because I think a lot of times writers do write in third person about themselves, because it's sort of an easier, maybe less emotionally overwhelming way of writing, because you sort of remove yourself from your own experience. And in that way, you're able to deal with it better on paper. So in the end, although my book is divided into sections, it's sort of just a blend of everything together.
And yes, I've read a number of your poems. I think they're amazing. And What She Remembers.
Thank you.
No, thank you. It's honestly, there's some great pieces there. And you mentioned What She Remembers. And yeah, I mean, this obviously touches on something that's happening at the moment. There's a huge conversation about this in society, you know. What I'm trying to say is, like, if writers and their work can contribute to the conversation, shape the issues and change attitudes, and help make that issue go away eventually as well.
Interesting question. You know, in my teens, when I was writing in my teens and even in my 20s, I really truly thought that by writing poems, I could change the world for the better, one poem at a time. For example, I could fight and end all the isms, for example, racism, sexism, by writing anti-racism and anti-sexism poems. Now that I'm a lot older and maybe a little bit wiser, hopefully, I've come to realize that a poem is really a work of art. It's a way for me to make sense of the world. It's also my hope that, you know, maybe through my poems that people can learn about other people's experiences or unfamiliar worlds, just as I learn when I'm writing these. And to learn to empathize more with other people. Here I'd like to mention an incredible acceptance letter that I received for this very poem, What She Remembers. It was the first poem, as I mentioned, that I ever published. And what the editor said when he sent me the acceptance letter was that he was not sending an automated message of acceptance, that his work did so much more for him than that. He said that my poem played to a lot of emotion in him, that it helped him remember how important it is to empathize with those who have struggled differently than us, and that it made him much more alert that morning as he spent the day with the women that he loves the most. And then he went on, but I think that's just an example of how, yes, a poem can change people's attitudes, maybe just for that day, but it made him think about what I wrote about. And so, yeah, I tend to write about difficult or controversial subjects that I feel strongly about in order to empathize with others, as he said, and to encourage others to care about and to empathize with people who struggle differently than us.
That's very beautiful. An amazing letter as well to receive.
Yes. I was shocked. I couldn't believe it.
I hope it's framed somewhere. For example, I guess touching on a similar thing would be the California on Fire poem, mm-hmm. which I think again talks about something that is being discussed in society at the moment, more about the environment and maybe mankind or humankind's impact on the natural world. And reading it, I had the impression that maybe you're discussing here, you can tell me if I'm wrong, but you're discussing here the function of a poet in an unfolding crisis. So, you know, for example, something with date rape or gender issues, there might be a new story every day. But it's a conversation we've been having maybe for a while now, and you can kind of like place yourself at the start of that conversation or something more recent. But if there's a forest fire in California, it's kind of an unfolding crisis, it's breaking news, it's in the moment. And I just had mm-hmm. the feeling that you're talking about a poet in this type of crisis as well, and how a poet can maybe take part in that or influence this unfolding crisis as well. Would that be a wrong interpretation, or would you explain it a different way?
Well, I think that poets naturally gravitate towards sort of these dramatic or devastated events as sources of inspiration, or, you know, that affect them on a deep emotional level, because you feel the need to write about these horrible things that, you know, they make you feel like you want to do something. But really, I don't think poems can change the fact of what happened. As I mentioned before, they help you make sense of the world. And they're ways of immortalizing people, recording places or events or moments that happen. But it's not something that can, like, poetry can't reverse what happened, and they can't prevent disasters from happening. So California on Fire is not going to prevent future wildfires. And it's not going to bring back the people who perished in the wildfire, for example. But perhaps someone who experienced this might read the poem and say, wow, there's somebody out there who understands what I went through. And maybe they'll feel a little less alone in the world. For example, in my book, there's a poem called Wish, and it's about a friend of mine who was kidnapped when we were both teenagers. It was published in a magazine, and a woman I didn't know on Twitter who had read the poem actually thanked me for writing it, because she said that she also had a friend who was kidnapped when she was a teenager. Can this poem bring back those girls? No, they're not going to bring them back. But maybe that reader felt a little comfort in knowing that there's somebody out there who has the sort of the shared, you know, the same shared sad memory of this event. And that's my hope as a writer, anyway, to connect with readers in that way.
It's again, I've said this word before, but it's beautiful. It's a beautiful hope to have as a writer. And I really like the emphasis that you have on empathy, and I guess using writing as a vehicle through which mm-hmm. people can understand each other or have shared experiences, which does, I imagine, lessen the pain of these things that can be quite traumatic or dramatic as well mm-hmm. in their nature. And there's just, well, we've almost come to the end of the interview as well. And I just want to discuss one poem. with you. Ice rink. You mentioned earlier you have like sometimes it's these very strong images and you put them together and then the truth of the poem comes out. And I think Ice Rink has some fantastic images in it. It's a wonderful piece of work. I was just wondering, could you just finish off this interview by just explaining some of the images and thoughts in this poem?
Of course, yes. I'd like to start by saying it is a bit difficult to analyze your own poem, because really the creation of poetry is an unconscious act. It surfaces from like a dreamlike state, so to speak. You know, it's like you're in a zone that you've warped yourself into. And so when you come out of that subjective world of the poem, it's hard to describe objectively what you just did. Sometimes you look at the words on the page and you say, where did those come from? But I will definitely do my best. This is a good poem to talk about, because it's close to my heart, and I'll explain why in a few minutes. There are certain things I think about when I write, such as cohesive images. I work a lot with extended metaphors, for example. With Ice Rink, my first thought was to create the atmosphere of an ice skating rink. Mm-hmm. So I tried to use as many watery or icy images as possible. So I used words such as chilled, floating, trace, sliding, slipping, spinning. You'll hear the gerunds. I did that consciously because I wanted to give the reader a feeling of gliding across the ice. I do have to say that this wasn't difficult for me at all, because I used to be a competitive figure skater when I was younger. I grew up in ice rinks, and I am teaching my children how to ice skate, of course. Which is why the images were very familiar to me. And by the way, the word stroke in the penultimate stanza, you know, people might not understand that because it's a skating term, but it means to push your feet either forwards or backwards to propel yourself against the ice. Anyway, this event was really, really sad and just shocking to me because of the fact that I used to be an ice skater. And so what I tried to do was elicit the shock and the horror and the sadness that washed over me upon learning that this ice rink was going to be made into a makeshift morgue, by juxtaposing sort of the dreadful images, such as, well, echoes catching their breath, or caskets clustered in the corner, or shadows spinning out of control, with the more delightful scenes of my daughter learning how to ice skate, to sort of show the contrast of the beautiful before and the horrific after of the pandemic. And in terms of the last line, some people have asked me about it, which is severed limbs skittering across the ice. You know, when you think of COVID, you don't think of skittering limbs. You know, limbs aren't cut off. But the last stanza talks about an axle. An axle is a jump in ice skating. And when you jump and you do an axle, for example, you come down, you land really hard, and those blades are really sharp. So my idea was that as the spirits of the people who had died from COVID are sort of, you know, coming out of the caskets and sort of sliding across the ice, I had the image of my daughter's blade coming down on these ghosts or these spirits, which is where the skittering limbs came from. And again, those blades are sharp. So that's kind of in a nutshell how I wrote that poem. This was one of the first pandemic poems I wrote back in March of 2020, right at the beginning of the confinement here in Spain, when some of our ice rinks were transformed into temporary morgues. Ice rink. There's a morgue now where we used to go ice skating. Wisps of silence, echoes catching their breath in the chilled air where pop music used to bounce and zip above our heads. But I can't tell you that. At five, death is a bug floating in a puddle, a trace of sadness in your chest, fleeting as the ice that dusts your gloves when you go sliding across the surface. Death is a word you pull on and off at whim, or fashion into a ball and toss at my face to gauge my reaction. For science, you draw coronavirus with a smiley face. I don't add the hands that strangle organs. I can't tell you my nightmares. Caskets wheeled through the entrance along the same path you took your first wobbly steps on doll-sized skates, bundled in a ski suit, helmet tilting off to one side. Caskets clustered in the corner where I taught you how to fall. Shadows spinning out of control in the place where you let go of my hands and glided all by yourself. Future ghosts wavering unobserved in your blades. Caskets pressed shoulder to shoulder to make room for more, while outside, the living must remain a cool meter apart. You wonder when you and your friend will be able to stroke hand in hand again. I say, let's pretend skate around the living room. One day, when you land your first clean axle, how will I find the strength to cheer when all I see is a haze of bodies spilling out of caskets, severed limbs skittering across the ice? Thank you.
Powerful stuff. It's fantastic. Julie, could you just tell us the name of your book and when it's coming out?
Yes, certainly. The name of the book is The Places We Empty. I'm afraid they haven't given me an exact date yet, but it will be coming out either in July or in August. I think probably late July or early August, but they haven't given me a specific date yet, but very soon, I think in a matter of weeks. So be on the lookout for it, and thank you.
Best of luck with it. I hope it goes really well. I'm sure it will. And thank you so much for being on this podcast today as well.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.